Hi and welcome back. Today on the show, we are talking to Kirk Loughlin. He is the Managing Director and Founder of Nearshore Americas. Last month, Nearshore Americas published an article entitled "The Philippines BPO Meltdown, What Went Wrong?" The article was referring to the Philippines' response to the COVID challenge across the outsourcing industry. It was a pretty harsh article, and of course, it raised a few eyebrows here in the Philippines. So I got Kirk on the show. We discussed that article, his thoughts on the article, as well as more generally what nearshoring is, the comparison between nearshoring and the Philippines, and more generally, we spoke about the outsourcing industry and the future of the industry. So it was a great opportunity to get Kirk on the show to really explore what nearshoring is, how it compares and differs to Philippine outsourcing, and just generally explore the different competitive environment that we are in. So I had a good conversation with Kirk, and of course it was good to be able to address that article that was published last month. If you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. Enjoy. Kirk, it's great to have you on the show. For those of us familiar with outsourcing but unfamiliar with nearshoring, can you give us an introduction to nearshoring and the main players involved in nearshoring?
Absolutely. So Derek, it's you know, a pretty common understanding in our part of the world that when we use the term nearshoring, we're discussing the practice of working with partners in the Americas, essentially. Why that's an important distinction is by making that classification, we're basically coming to understand that the client and provider are within, you know, either in the same time zone or within 2 or 3 hours of a time zone change, which has become an ever more significant issue. So, you know, that's sort of number one. Number two, also significant, is proximity. So obviously, providers and customers can get together and meet in person, although that's obviously a much more difficult thing to do now. And finally, implied in the concept of nearshoring is cultural affinity. One of the other three, you know, kind of crucial pillars of the nearshore concept is cultural awareness, cultural affinity. And by the way, just to be absolutely clear, and by no means do we feel in the Americas we have exclusive usage of that term. It's we've seen it pop up quite a bit over the years relative to Western European clients serviced by, you know, Eastern European providers. So again, we're just playing off a very similar concept.
It seems to be blossoming now, doesn't it? The concept of offshore staffing, and as you say, there's nearshoring in Western Europe now, which is obviously servicing the southern parts of Europe and the UK. So it just seems to be blossoming across the world. And I think what we'll eventually see is effectively a balancing of global employment and staff costs eventually, yeah?
Yeah. I'm curious to see, you know, down the road, if there'll be parity on the cost question. I think we're a ways away from that. But you know, we've been at this now close to 12 years. So when we first arrived, we had, you know, we obviously, this train had already left the station. There was a lot that had gone on before we started organization, but I kind of think we're in what we consider to be Nearshore 3.0. There's definitely some very interesting things happening since about March or April of this year. And I'm sure we can get into that a little bit. But strangely enough, it's as if, despite being neighbors and despite having, you know, certain ties historically, a lot of clients in North America are seemingly discovering Latin America and Caribbean for the first time relative to these types of services.
Right, Right. What are the main, who are the main players within what you would refer to as nearshoring and Central and South America? Who are the sort of shining lights of experience in service provision?
Right. Well, this is where it gets a little, and I'll try to keep it pretty simple, but it does get a little complicated because we're talking about, easily 12, 15 or so countries with very viable, export services, platforms, capabilities, histories. Countries, sort of the leading lights, if you will, are Mexico, Costa Rica, Colombia, Brazil. Brazil is a bit more complicated because that's a country generally focused on its internal market, but not exclusively. Argentina and Uruguay are also very significant. And then sort of also significant, very much more on the BPO, customer experience portion would be the Caribbean and Central America. There's so in terms of perspective of countries, that's just a very broad overview of what's happening there. As far as providers and what we've seen over the years, we have literally hundreds of companies providing all kinds of business services from software testing and software engineering development, digital transformation services, obviously automation and robotics process automation, all the way over to any range of issue services tied to what we used to call business process outsourcing. And within that framework, we have obviously the same types of large companies you have in the Philippines, many of the familiar names that we would have all have heard of, Sitel and Alorica, Teleperformance, and then largely on the digital services side, we also have very familiar names there as well. Tata Consultancy, Infosys, Wipro, Cognizant, Capgemini. And I definitely don't want to overlook the fact that we have a whole bunch of interesting companies that have emerged out of Latin America and have done extremely well with this nearshore premise. Some of them are exclusively still nearshore. Others have actually grown up and graduated out of that concept. So one of our favorite companies to talk about is a company called Globant, which was started in a bar room in Argentina, probably close to 20 years ago now. Five founders, former consultants, got together, created Globant, somehow went out and got Google as one of their first clients, and managed to get all the way to NASDAQ, and now they're a publicly traded company. I think last I checked, maybe 15 or 20,000 employees, but they're worldwide now. Very impressive story there.
There's still growth in the industry, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely.
So, Kirk, you are the founder and managing director of Nearshore Americas. How does that fit in then to the Nearshore America ecosystem?
Well, my whole background, Derek, has been as a journalist and particularly as a business journalist, technology business journalist, for about 10 years prior to starting this company. So I was keenly aware of what industry specific journalism looks like, having very specific business information tailored to specific industries. So around 2008, company I was working for in New York City was in search of a call center partner to help us drive some subscriptions and some attendance at our events. And sort of a long story, a circuitous route led me to discover a partner in Barbados. I didn't know anything about what nearshore meant. I thought it might be related to fishing or something like that. And upon discovering this partner and upon seeing some really great services supporting our business, I did some looking around on the internet, and I realized, maybe Gartner had a 5-year-old report on the nearshore market. Frost & Sullivan might have had some aging content. but there was absolutely no credible authoritative resource for the industry. So that's really all that did happen was, you know, myself and some of the other people helped start this company recognized that there was an addressable market with organizations who define themselves as being nearshore providers. And that really, you know, again, and again, we didn't create the term nearshore in that concept, but effectively we felt like, and we've seen this time and time again, that there's definitely a place for a business to be, a true balanced and neutral observer of what goes on in a business sector like this. And we take that responsibility very seriously. We continue to churn out a lot of really good independently written journalism and news content. We also have lots of resources and guidance and insights, white papers, webinars, all kinds of products and resources to help typically the decision maker in the process gain and accelerate their understanding of what that part of the region can do, what the partners in Latin America and the Caribbean can do for those clients.
We see this so often with so many entrepreneurs and business people that they have a taste of offshore staffing and they can't believe, you know, the value proposition of this, and they're so taken that often they pivot their entire business model and then they adopt the model of offshore staffing, and it's almost, you know, selling the dream to others. And it really is quite incredible that, you know, it's out there and there is this sort of, I suppose, the primary driver, which is global inequality in salaries, that just provides this incredible sort of buying power across the globe, and then mix it with executive talent that can, you know, provide business solutions. It's super powerful, isn't it? But I think most entrepreneurs, most business people, they embrace the industry by becoming another service provider. And then it's people like yourself and I think also Outsource Accelerator, where we see a different opportunity, and it's in promotion and education about the industry and connecting the industries in those countries to the consumers in the West. Where do you see your primary service provision, and how do you serve the market with Nearshore Americas?
Right. Well, we have a couple of different hats we wear here. Again, we really take our, you know, this thing I was talking about earlier, being an authority of the nearshore market, is a very, it's a pretty ambitious type of undertaking, because we're talking about covering a region that's, you know, north of 600 million people with, countries as, emerging countries from places like Haiti all the way up to very well-developed or countries like Curacao, for example, or Costa Rica. So by providing that information, by generating a strong database and a strong following, we are then able to support our sponsors for their marketing programs, for their lead generation programs, and that's delivered across a whole bunch of interesting processes we offer, white papers, webinars, live events. We have a conference called Nearshore Nexus that's been around 11 years now. Unfortunately, it was postponed this year, but that takes place in New York every year. And that's become the kind of home base for the nearshore industry. We also do some consulting on the side. Typically, it is the buyer organizations, clients in the U.S., trying to get a handle on the kind of vendors they need to be looking at, the kinds of considerations they need to be listing as they begin their pursuit of a vendor relationship. So given where we sit, the years of experience we have, we feel like we have a lot of value in really navigating. And, I'm sure you know well, Derek, one shouldn't underestimate the unique features of some of these countries. They're not all the same. The labor laws are not all the same. The appetite to support foreign clients is not all the same. Issues like personal safety, telecommunications, office parks, airlift, on and on. And there's a whole lot to that issue. I mean, I've always been super impressed with the recognition by leadership in the Philippines that you've really got to marshal citizens, and you've got to really push them in terms of developing competence and understanding what the opportunity is. And certain countries in this region have taken a very serious approach to this opportunity. And that what I mean by that is that government institutions, investment agencies have really focused on the conversation and have become competent in regard to knowing how this industry works. It takes a while to understand. For those on the outside, it's a little complicated, but I have to give a lot of credit to certain countries who've really, really developed their, you know, their expertise in the conversation.
I think the Philippines has done incredibly well. I think they were early to notice this opportunity, in kind of 25 years ago, and they took a stance to nurture the what became the golden goose for the country. And the Philippines has a lot of challenges, and not least the fact that there's 7,000 islands in the country, so it's a pretty disconnected country from itself, so it's harder to get infrastructure across the country. But I suppose at least it's one state, so there's only one legislative environment, and it's a big population of about 100 million people, well educated, and so it's easy to create a more sort of aligned national service provision, I suppose. You, on the other hand, you're dealing with a lot of different states, aren't you? Sort of dozens of countries almost, and I suppose different sort of political stances towards it. Maybe some of them aren't even that friendly with America, which I assume would be seen as
Absolutely.
the main client. Just sort of zooming out a little bit, it seems that there are four. It's becoming a four-horse race. You almost have Eastern Europe, you have India, you have the Philippines, you have nearshore Americas, and then of course the sort of the blossoming providers in Southeast Asia. But what would you see as the main characteristics between them? Are you sort of mindful of the other horses in the race, or are you just focusing squarely on nearshore Americas?
It's a really, really great question, Derek, because I often go back to that. I think on one hand, our entire mission is to ensure we're doing a competent job of thoroughly analyzing and scrutinizing this concept of nearshore. So that's really job number one for us. But within that discussion, naturally comes the opportunities to make comparisons. I mean, there's no question that we've been asked and challenged and invited to make comparisons. And I think often the comparison comes down to, when we're sort of looking for guidance on those kinds of questions, we're ultimately going right to the source, the clients themselves, the organizations that make these multi-million dollar decisions all the time as to where to place work and why they're placing it there. And I will say, there's tremendous talent in all these locations. And I in a person on a personal level, actually lived in the Philippines for a while in Dumaguete. I absolutely love the country. I love the people. So for us, we continue to believe that there's large amounts of work available now, and it will continue to expand. And I really do believe it will, raise the tide will raise all the ships out there. We've certainly seen it in the nearshore market. I think because this market has started much later than India or the Philippines, there is a certain amount of catch up. But even now that we're well, into the COVID era, I will say something here that I don't think has changed, and that is there is absolutely no way Latin America is somehow going to overcome India or the Philippines. I don't think that's really the question. It's not either or at all. I think, Latin America has its place. There's going to continue to be growth. It's significant growth, but if you look at it in comparison to the numbers of employees in this business, there's a long way to go before anyone's about to start proclaiming it to be the leader in the race. So I think that's just important to keep in mind as far as context goes.
You recently had an article about a month ago, the Philippines BPO meltdown, what went wrong? The article was obviously about COVID, and we're all globally struggling to adapt to the new world, the new environment, and as you know, with emerging economies, infrastructure isn't necessarily there for everyone at the best of times. So these things are a scramble. And generally, offshore outsourcing, it's very strong in terms of business continuity plans, but I think COVID just took us all unaware. In reflection of the BPO meltdown and the Philippines, it was pretty sort of harsh in terms of the Philippines' ability to cope with the fast changing environment. Do you think how did the Philippines really compare though, compared to the rest of the world where everyone else was really struggling to just get their work done? This podcast is brought to you by Outsource Accelerator. We are the world's leading outsourcing marketplace and advisory. We help big and small businesses with their outsourcing needs, and we can help you too. We cover everything from business and staffing strategy, optimal outsourcing structures, implementations, and fully managed services. If you're already outsourcing, about to start, or somewhere in between, then we can ensure that you get the best from outsourcing. That's the best prices, best terms, and of course, the best results from your outsourcing practices. We list over 700 outsourcing suppliers on our website, host this leading outsourcing podcast, and have over 5,000 pages of content. Because we span the entire market, we can ensure that you get the best deal possible. We offer everything from light brokerage, co-managed services, through to fully managed solutions. Get in touch today. Visit us at outsourceaccelerator.com/quote. Mention that you're a podcast listener, and we will give you special attention plus a 10% discount. This is for a limited time only. Go to outsourceaccelerator.com/quote.
It's that exact question, Derek, is what I was asking the organizations that we're familiar with based here in the United States who have presence in India. I mean, sorry, the Philippines. So we undertook that particular report or investigation with that specific question. Explain it, break it down for us. What went wrong? Where did it go wrong? If you're provider A, why are you deciding to, move a couple thousand positions out of the Philippines into Latin America? So that's really the basis for that. And to be honest, I think some part, depending on the organization, every organization has a different set of justifications. But the one I think I've heard most consistently is that this entire experience has really intensified the question of location and diversifying one's footprint. It may be too early to tell, but a lot of people I'm talking to are saying, well, we're going to see an even greater number of countries being sourced for the purposes of redundancy and dealing with crises as they hit. I think the other, you know, we don't know the full story here, but, you know, all kinds of countries are on a different pace relative to getting out of the lockdown experience. You know, even the United States, I'll be not the first one to declare that the United States is absolutely well behind the rest of the world in terms of confidently emerging from this wave one. And I don't think there's any doubt that that's got to have be weighing on the minds of people who have to, you know, make staffing decisions. So it's a long-winded way of saying that I think this particular crisis did put much greater pressure on individual companies and enterprises to say, well, wait a minute. We've got opportunities, you know, we've got, you know, locations and partners 3 hours north by plane out of Dallas. You know, why haven't you investigated Costa Rica or Colombia, which, by the way, are both on fire as destinations? And I think it's sort of some of the biases that this country has dealt with for many years around Latin America are being challenged more and more. And that's part of the picture as well.
And the essence, I mean, how is Costa Rica and Colombia? How are they coping with COVID? Are they clear of COVID? And is their infrastructure better to adapt to a 1 in 100 year pandemic?
Yeah. Well, if you asked me that question 2 months ago, we would have had a fairly positive story to tell about Costa Rica, but I think it was written a little too soon. So Costa Rica did a marvelous job at the beginning, and I think was one of the first countries, if I'm not mistaken, in Central America for sure to have reopened. And I do believe by June, they were welcoming at one time visitors from abroad. But since that time, there was a resurgence. And obviously all kinds of reactions to that. So I don't have a specific understanding where it is today, but I think they're grappling with the same sort of challenges a lot of us are in other countries. As far as Colombia, I don't know that it's a question of the COVID crisis influencing the decisions on staffing. I think the greater issue is the overall readiness of the worker population to support work from home. So simple things like having a room in the house that's private and available to the worker, the ease of turning up the telecommunications infrastructure, you know, the cost around all those things, some of the security questions are coming up a lot, and monitoring. I think those are also factors, but by and large, the Colombia, you know, consistently over the last 3 or 4 years has been a real darling of our industry. It's about a 40 million person country. It's larger than any other country south of the United States, aside from Mexico. Has really come a long way from some of the more darker times 25 years ago. And I think some of those are factors as well, getting back to it just being overlooked.
There's a bit of a paradox, isn't there, in that, you know, I think when times are good, when things are stable, people become a little bit complacent and they're like, you know, our offshoring in Colombia and the Philippines, they're doing a great job. Maybe we can cut their pay by 10, 20%, try and automate them, try and reduce staffing by 30%. You know, they're making too much money. This thing is running well. But then when the things are shaken up a little bit or the tide goes out, you realize that actually things are in place for a reason. And emerging countries can only provide cheaper staffing, which is, you know, one of the primary drivers, because it is an emerging economy. And you know, for the individual staff and employees, it is a good deal for them, but there's not a lot of infrastructure supporting this, and that's why the outsourcing suppliers, the BPOs, and the infrastructure are there to ensure business continuity. But as soon as you go outside of the bubble, then you're back into an environment. You know, you can't sort of sign contracts for $3 an hour and then expect everyone to be able to work from home in their own private office and have national broadband and, you know, sort of a sound public transport. It's just incongruent, isn't it? And I think there needs to be a balancing that the BPO infrastructure is very valuable in itself. And, you know, there's always a sort of, I suppose, lean towards underpaying, cutting contracts, making things tighter and tighter, and then you're not really valuing the value proposition that the BPO providers offer. Does that make sense?
You know, I couldn't agree with you more, Derek. I mean, one of the responsibilities we take very seriously are investigating claims such as the following. So on more than one occasion, we've heard of instances where a provider will go into a country and seek to seal some kind of agreement with the governing organization, you know, the government itself, or, you know, a province or something around, you know, getting some assurance that they will be the only BPO permitted to do business or permitted in to operate. We've seen other variations on that theme. There is a very, very large, well-known outsourcing client who's set up some very interesting limitations on competitors being within a certain number of miles of where they send their work. What I'm getting at is these are indications of it's all about our needs as the client. And I find that to be exploitative. And I don't think it's really the norm. I think most providers do their very best given the competitive stakes that we're dealing with. And I don't have an easy answer to this, but I do think there is very interesting discussions I'm aware of that have gone on at the World Trade Organization in the last few years with countries rightfully questioning how much they want to, quote unquote, give away when it comes to foreign organizations doing business in their countries relative to tax holidays and things like that. I think that's an appropriate conversation. It is highly competitive, but at the end of the day, to your point, there needs to be a reasonable trade-off for, you know, the expectations those organizations have.
We are seeing a trend through COVID. I mean, there's a general trend towards remote work and work from home across the globe because everyone has been forced to adopt this. But then within outsourcing, you've got a lot of clients questioning whether their staff need to return back to an office. And I think outsourcing for a long time has been one of the major pillars of service provision has been the office environment and the reliable office environment that comes with that. Have you seen a shift of clients in terms of what they perceive as being outsourcing and where the value lies in outsourcing and kind of questioning whether we need offices in the future or whether this will just be a sort of big remote kind of trend?
I see that cutting both ways so far, Derek. I'm pretty surprised and you know by the willingness of so many clients to basically put their faith in the work from home model. What I'm hearing by and large is it's been very successful for the most part. There are potential flaws for sure. You know, processing credit cards at home, people will try to tell you that it can be foolproof and fully protected. I'm not fully sold on that personally. But I think there's a whole nother bunch of clients who say, wait a minute, I'm just not comfortable with that kind of setup. I want to see my team when I come to town. I want to get a sense of the camaraderie and you know, team building that a lot of us have come to know as an essential part of this business. I'm a bit skeptical that people are making these proclamations that, we're going to sort of be work from home forever industry. I really don't buy that. I think it will certainly service us all for as long as it's necessary. But, one thing's for sure, of the many organizations and delivery centers I've been to, a lot of these people like these jobs because of the social aspects and the ability to find mentors and the ability to grow professionally. Obviously, much harder to do if you're in the upstairs bedroom at your suburban home. And I just think if I'm a 27-year-old or 22-year-old, that's really the life I want. I'm not so sure, but we shall.
Yeah, I completely agree.
Yeah.
I think it's a we've been working from offices or workplaces for about 300 years now, and I think it's a very short run experiment, this remote work and work from home and digital nomads. And it's far too early to conclude that this is a better way of doing things. And I think over the medium term, there's going to be a lot of cracks in the system as you bring younger, more formative staff through that, aren't learning from their co-workers and colleagues in the same environment. It's going to be really hard to create a sort of disciplined professional workforce with any kind of cohesive environment, isn't it?
Sure. No question. I couldn't agree with you more.
With the Philippines, I see definite waves of development. Without doubt, 25 years ago when it started, it was only the multinationals and conglomerates that could access offshore staffing because the setup costs were huge and it was only viable if you had a team of 500 doing the same thing, for example. Whereas now, with everything in the cloud, everything is going digital, everything is cheaper. Offshore staffing is available and accessible to SMEs across the globe. So whether you're a plumber in Connecticut or you're a solopreneur just starting out, you can now access offshore staffing that was not available 20 years ago. So I see this huge trend now of the growth and opportunity in the Philippines is no longer enterprises because all of those enterprises in the world are already outsourcing. And so that growth is plateauing. Yet I see about 50 million more jobs coming from small and medium-sized enterprises across the globe into offshore staffing solutions. I see a lot of the Philippine industry not really recognizing that because they prefer the enterprise clients, they prefer the big contracts. Where do you does that ring bells with you for nearshoring? How do you see the sort of maturation of the nearshore environment as you see it?
It's a really, really good point. And it's interesting to ponder because a lot of that does happen. I'm made aware of some of those smaller type organizations. I do have to say that, a whole lot of providers in our market would be thrilled to pick up, 50 staff positions, on a deal. I don't know how that would fly in the Philippines, but we're in this particular market, 50 or 100 is it's pretty nice, So it may just be a certain what fits for an organization relative to how they're set up and how they can scale. I do agree with what you're saying. I do think some of that is sort of a consumer to business per business play, sort of a instead of a B2B, it just may be consumers looking for support on various things or solo entrepreneurs. I think that will continue to go forward, and by no means do I necessarily think only the Philippines or Latin America are the only options in town for that. I think it's all over the globe, literally. But I definitely also think that when you look at the large volumes of business in the pipeline, it's going to keep growing. And I think the numbers are really, really strong, for these Fortune, 100 companies, many of which have digital agendas that are really ambitious. I do think the size of those deals in many respects will continue to grow.
Without doubt, I think one of the strengths of South and Central America is the language, and of course, it's fairly widely spoken across the US. Do you see large part of the requirements being underpinned by the requirement to speak Spanish or Hispanic or those regional languages? Is that sort of underpinning a lot of the decisions to come nearshore?
Honestly, it's not. I'd say easily, 95 to 98% of the business we're aware of, the real thrust that powers this industry is the bilingual individuals, people who are either able to converse in English, meet with their teams doing software projects and able to interact with clients either spoken or written English, supporting clients with chat in English. All of those things are the real drivers. I think the Spanish language part is significant largely when the provider's dealing with a domestic market or situations where maybe a Honduras or an El Salvador might be supporting a larger market like Mexico, or even demand for Portuguese servicing Brazil might be provided from a place like Uruguay or Paraguay. But overall, it's all about English. And getting back to what we were talking about earlier, it's governmental programs that look across 10 and 20 year spans to really think about how do we mobilize and get the population really ready for business level English. And that, the game has already begun. And again, it's countries that are savvy about this, that can look past the next presidential election, are really going to be in a strong position long term.
I get really excited thinking about the future of outsourcing. You just sort of mentioned a 20, 30-year window, and I am fanatical about the outsourcing industry and the value that it provides, but I also think in 30 years, potentially the industry itself could be redundant. I think that the industry enables global employment when global employment is difficult. And 20 years, it was really di 20 years ago, it was really difficult to employ people globally. Whereas now, we're talking over Zoom or similar. Most people are having meetings across Zoom. A lot of major US businesses have said you never have to come back to the office. There's a move towards remote, and all of the points of friction of globalized employment are sort of being chipped away at and removed. Do you think that, as 30 years from now, when there's an incredible improvement in technology and the way that we interact online, is there just going to be one globalized workforce? And would that sort of remove the relevance of offshore staffing providers?
It's a really big question, Derek. I mean that there's so many different pieces to that. Everything from where will we be on labor arbitrage, where will we be in terms of the appetite and willingness of the so-called next generation of professionals? Will the typical owner of a mutual fund in the United States be comfortable dealing with an automated platform? To me, today, I cannot imagine when it comes to really crucial issues such as, life insurance or dealing with your financial matters or education. There's all kinds of things that, to me, from where I stand today, you really need a human interaction to navigate. But I do have an 18-year-old and a 15-year-old, and my 18-year-old is really not interested in speaking to customer service agents all that much. So I think that'll be an interesting driver. But there's a lot out there, and the disruptions of COVID, I think, have helped us, if anything, for me, kind of scale back my vision past the next year or so, to be totally honest with you.
Yeah, that's a very good point, isn't it? I think we narrow our views when we're in the midst of a crisis. Just coming back closer to home, and it would be good to get your view on this, borrowing your crystal ball again. But the political climate of the US, I mean, it looks like they're about to start World War III with China. But it, you know, Donald Trump has for a long time tried to bring things onshore again. Do you see any sort of political moves, whether maybe because of COVID or with, you know, regardless of COVID, for there being stronger and stronger legislation to keep work at home? Or do you think that's a leaking bucket that can't really
I think the word that comes to mind is a lot of noise. There's a lot of noise year after year. I mean, if anything really significant regarding the, you know, bringing jobs back to the United States, a lot of it is political grandstanding. Yes, it happens. Yes, certain organizations do it without seeking the acclaim. Others do it for very political, public reasons. Despite all of those things happening, there's still tons of offshoring and tons of nearshoring for all of the same reasons we discussed earlier. I do tend to think that there are very specific, you know, bilateral relationships that do mean a lot when it comes to who we have sitting in the White House. Right now, we have a president who probably couldn't name five capital cities in Latin America, and I'm not joking. So presumably, the next president will know where Haiti is and how to get how to find Honduras and have a much greater understanding of what the region offers. And I think that setting that kind of tone. And, you know, Cuba is a great example. We really went off the rails with Cuba since the current president came to office. That's really unfortunate for both sides. Cuba is a tremendously interesting country with a whole lot of very well-educated people who would love to be part of the global, you know, commercial scene. They'd love to bring their talents to the market. Some of them still are, but the relationship we have with that country is really complicated, and it stood in the way of that kind of advance. So that's the sort of stuff I look for in terms of, you know, specific change. But I think a lot of the rest of it is just noise.
And finally, Kirk, the, you know, I certainly don't envy you. We, you know, I think we're doing a very similar job. I'm trying to aggregate Philippine outsourcing and sort of present it to prospective customers in a coherent way. I only have one legislative environment to deal with, one country, you know, and one sort of culture and people. Whereas you're trying to aggregate, you know, over 20 countries, and they're enormously diverse. So I certainly take my hat off to you. Thank you. Kirk, if anyone wants to know more about Nearshore Americas or what you do and how you serve the community, how can they do that?
Sure. I think the easiest way to reach me personally is on my LinkedIn account. I have conversations all the time with people around the world. And obviously, just visit Nearshore Americas. We've got a wonderfully rich weekly newsletter we'd be happy to provide for free to any new readers. We'd love to share knowledge, and that's really the place to start. From there, you can get connected to our Facebook, Twitter, and some of the other platforms we're touching.
Thank you, Kirk Loughlin.
Thank you, Derek. Appreciate it.
That was Kirk Loughlin. He is the Managing Director and Founder of Nearshore Americas. If you want any of the show notes, go to outsourceaccelerator.com/podcast. And as always, if you want to ask us anything, then just drop us an email to ask@outsourceaccelerator.com. See you next time.